This is the Everything is a Primary Source podcast, the show where we build history through pop culture. I'm your host, Eric Paul. This podcast is dedicated to treating popular media, such as movies, on the same level as artifacts that inform visitors while on display at a museum. It's only appropriate, then, that today's episode about a movie was recorded at a museum this past summer. Here's my drop-in guest, JF, and I, talking about 1964's Dr. Strangelove, or How I Learned to Stop Worrying and Love the Bomb.
We're not broadcasting right now, we're recording live at Strawberry Bank Museum, right outside the boat shop. And this is your first time here, you said, right?
Yes, it is.
Where are you from?
New Ipswich, New Hampshire.
Okay. How long of a drive was that to get here?
Hour and a half.
That's not bad.
That's not too bad.
Especially on a day like this.
Oh, it's a beautiful drive.
Yeah.
Yeah, the 101 and the 95, the traffic's amazing.
Yeah. It sounds like California almost. The 101.
You know? I know. Yeah, exactly.
So you looked at my table. I'm kind of set back a little bit from the road here, so It kind of looks like I'm having a yard sale. But
I thought so too.
Yeah, I'm like, yeah, come on over.
This DVD. Yeah.
And in a way, that's kind of how. And you know, you and I were chatting before I hit record. I mean, it's kind of what this is all about. Is that even when you go to a yard sale, all that stuff that people have on their tables and everything, that's technically artifacts. I mean, it's all the past for us.
Well, it's always strange to go to an estate sale because you know the person died.
Yeah.
It's the last of their possessions and it's whatever the family doesn't want. But yeah, as they say, when another dead man's trash
is somebody else's treasure.
I know.
Yeah.
And I mean, if I saw any of these items, I'd be like, I'd be picking a few of them for sure.
Yeah. We go up to Goodwill by the pound. We've actually gone, as a family, gone beyond just regular Goodwilling.
We go
to only by the pound, where you pay for everything. They weigh it out for you, and they just have these big troughs of stuff. And that's where I find a lot of what I have here is at thrift stores and things, because, like you said, a lot of that is estate sales type stuff, too.
New Hampshire is a bit of a hoarder's paradise. I'm not originally from New Hampshire or New England. I'm originally from PEI, Canada. And I find that, like, when you have big barns and you have people who tend to stay inside a lot of the winter, you got a hoarder's paradise. Yeah. You can't get that in, like, you know, anywhere else in the country.
It's very Yankee. I remember hearing somebody one time saying, you know, of course I couldn't park my car in the garage because I'm a Yankee and it's full of crap. So we can't get our cars in there.
Yeah, magpie people. That's what they are.
Yeah. So from my table, I actually just grabbed this up this morning. It was in my house, but I'll be honest with you, I've never seen Dr. Strangelove. I've owned that DVD for a long time. I bought it as some part of, you know, like a two-for-one type thing. I know enough of it. I feel like The Simpsons have covered most of the story.
Yeah.
When Tim Burton made Mars Attacks in the late 90s is very similar, and it's a lot of the way that they use, like, you know, in this one, Peter Sellers plays lots of different characters in it and things like that. But you said it's one of your favorite movies.
Yeah, so I remember seeing it when I was younger, and then I saw it again in, like, history class in high school, and I've seen it, I think, probably again later on. My father was like, you have to watch this film, and I'm like, I'm nine.
Yeah.
But he was right. It's a good film, and it's just a fascinating sort of, the basic premise of the story is it's 1960 something, and essentially a colonel, lieutenant general who runs an Air Force base goes nuts and orders the aircraft, you know, these B-52 bombers that typically fly loiter near the USSR, essentially telling them by coded signal, guys, there's been a nuke attack on America, you have to go and drop your bombs on the Soviet Union. And essentially this process, freaks out the president of the United States, and he has his own war room, and he's constantly back and forth with his own counterpart in the USSR while they're trying to recall the bombers and accept one who, for whatever reason, manages to get to its target. And the Soviets release sort of information near the end that they have a doomsday device, that if a nuclear weapon is dropped on the Soviet Union, they will essentially incinerate the whole planet with their doomsday device. Now, it's a serious topic, but it's satire because every single character goes above and beyond what is reasonable conduct. And there's a lot of, I think it's a very tense time in America. It's a tense time in the world.
Yeah.
And it takes on just a sort of extraordinary satirical, taking a serious topic and makes it very sort of strange. For example, the president is a sort of serious kind of Truman-esque kind of guy, but he's always sort of saying rather silly or nerdy things. There's a pilot who's played by a character actor named Slim Pickens. I'm not kidding, that's his name. And he plays this aircraft pilot who's just serious. He's wearing a cowboy hat. He's like, we're going to go kill some Ruskies today. He played it straight. You know, Kubrick gave him the script and said, you know, told his whole cast and production team, production assistants, don't tell him that this is actually a satire.
Yeah, it's a comedy.
And, you know, things like that. And, and of course, the general who, you know, sort of calls the, we want to nuke the planet, he's also just over the top, sort of, what's the word for it, paranoid. Like, he talks about, like, you know, fluoridation of the water is a communist conspiracy to steal our precious bodily fluids. When fluoridation was being introduced into people's water supply to, you know, keep your teeth clean, but people thought it was a communist takeover. And it's just taking on all these kind of common human American sort of concerns and just putting it to the natural conclusion, which is what good satire is. That's why it makes it a great film.
That's and such a great. I really appreciate. I don't think I have to watch it now. You covered it so well.
I'm missing so much.
No, but that's so. I mean, you sold it great. And it seems like was it high school that you watched it?
We watched it in high school.
And I assume you were studying the time period, right?
It was like a modern 20th century. And my favorite teacher of all time, Miss Alyssa Novak, was our teacher, and she's great. My brother and sister, who are older than me, also had her, and they had always warned me, like, oh, when you get her, you'll have a lot of fun. She was the kind of teacher that really does inspire you to be like, oh, this is, she doesn't make history come alive, but she really gives you context you wouldn't think about. And so you get many different views on historical events, and if you like history, you love history after taking a course with her.
That's the best kind of teacher there is. And it sounds like she and I are very like-minded in that, you know, because I think a lot of teachers, and I put myself in that same category when I first started, especially, I would show movies about history.
Yeah.
And, you know, like, I don't know, Glory or, you know, something.
Yeah, that's a good film.
It's a great film. And and that one's probably a bad example just because of how much research was put into it to make it accurate and to make sure that they represented it well. But a lot of times history teachers will put on, you know, well, here's Indiana Jones because we're learning about the 30s. You know, just that's an embellishment.
But
the other
way. That could happen.
It's like just kind of throwing something that's set in the past, but not realizing that it's actually a primary source of the time period in which it was made.
Right.
You know, because of all the stories that you can tell in history, why do you want to tell this one? That says something about the times. And so it's perfect that your teacher selected Dr. Strangelove as a movie to show, because not only is it from the time period, but it's also about the time period.
You know, yeah, well, that's both. That's historiography, right?
Right.
So do you talk in your podcast about historiography? Because that's something I learned in that class.
It is actually a historiography, especially when we do things like, you know, I have this book, or even actually, it's interesting. I took a historiography class in graduate school.
Yeah.
And that's why I have the Ulysses S. Grant book that you're looking at.
Yeah, that's a good
piece. Because
I
did my thesis on presidential biographies, autobiographies.
Yeah.
Because his was really the first. And basically, you know, it adds a huge, it throws a wrench into historiography when a president, knowingly that they have, I think the time is like 40 years from when they leave office to when their presidential papers are made public to themselves tell the story.
Yeah.
But something like this, The Fort and the Flag, this book was published in 1977, and it's about the Revolutionary War here in Portsmouth.
Okay.
And it's, you know, that's a great historiography thing. It's like, okay, well, you know, of course in the 70s, there's lots of stuff about the Revolutionary War because it was the bicentennial of all of it. But they're going to give you, they have no choice because of the time period that they're in to present it in a very 1970s way. Like their history is explained differently.
Yeah.
wherever you are and whenever you are, and by different people. So, you know, history is in itself primary sources. You know, people make a book.
Yeah.
Your textbooks are all primary sources.
It drives my mom periods. Nuts, by the way.
Yeah.
So she's a historian. Her focus is on military art and art history.
Yeah.
She teaches, well, she was a curator at the Canadian War Museum. And she writes. She writes a lot of books. If you look her up, her name is Dr. Laura Brandon. And I'm sort of totally, what's the word for it? I'm raising her profile on your podcast. Maybe. but she does, when we talk, you know, we start getting bored and we start talking about more than the weather. She mentions, like, I have to write this book. And she has to take another take on a topic, with including more Native viewpoints, female viewpoints, people of color viewpoints. And these are areas that she would be like, I'm not 100% certain about a lot of this stuff because it's not written down. Mm-hmm. I have to base on oral material or material that's like interpreted by other people. And then I have to take that. And it's hard because, you know, we have a white European waspy view of history where if it's written down, that's like the best primary material. Yeah. And if you want to give a perspective of, let's say, a lesser known individual or lesser known perspective, you don't have as much material, so it becomes conjecture and it's difficult. Yeah. And I get it. Like if I was a historian, I had to write from perspectives with material that's not very good primary source, or at least doesn't meet the rigor that we're used to with waspy white European views, which is just the best because it's the best preserved.
Yeah,
it's hard. And
that's where we turn to our friends, the archaeologists, because they're, you know, digging stuff up. Or I worked with it. There's an organization that I've worked with recently called the Society for Commercial Archaeology.
Really?
And they deal with things above ground.
Okay.
So a lot of like old signage and billboards and roadside.
That's very cool.
Roadside Americana.
And they got rid of that stuff in the 60s, but sometimes it's kept up.
And what's interesting is their group, speaking of historiography, no surprise, they started in the 1970s.
Nice.
And it was, I guess, a professor at University of Vermont who kind of had this awakening of, you know, we're preserving all this stuff from 200 years, 150 years ago. What about our own time period? You know, it's like the 20th century should not be overlooked either.
Yeah.
And, you know, now we're at a point now where that organization actually is putting a lot of its attention towards malls. Like they do some preservation. Mainly their preservation is just to be calling people's attention to things. It's not about, you know, save the mall. It's more just like, hey, these things are still with us. I think sometimes, and my son who's wandering around can attest to this. I don't know if you can be heard or not, but do you remember that cemetery that we went to right next to the mall in New York? So a couple years ago, we were down in near the like Westchester County, New York.
Yeah, no, we used to live in New York City. So okay, so I don't think I've been to Westchester too much, but
just north, near, just across the Tappan Zee Bridge is the I think it's the Palisades Mall. It's this huge shopping mall.
Okay, I think I may have.
And you can see it from, you know, the highway, and they built it in the late 90s. And there's a African American burying ground there that they, I guess the mall developers offered to pay to move all of the graves, and the owners of it, the families were like, no, well, it's going to stay right where it belongs. And so in like basically surrounding the cemetery, which has a lot of Union war veterans buried there and, you know, quite a few, you know, everybody there is notable, but it was just like, you know, right in the background is Dick's Sporting Goods. And, you know, it's like, it was weird to say the least, but I was.
Well, they see the movie Poltergeist and they're like, hey, you can't just move the headstones.
Here's what. And then we were in San Diego, California a few weeks ago. And there's another cemetery in the old town of San Diego where they paved over some of the cemetery because they, you know, they needed to make a road. And so they, instead of moving the graves, they just didn't move them. And so there's these little like coin size markers throughout. How many did you count? 12. About 12.
Wow.
And they're in rows, but just like on the sidewalk and on the street. And it's just like, you know, I just think that, modernity, you know, what seems important now, we're like, oh, malls. This mall's, I mean, when we went to that mall, it was Columbus Day weekend, which is usually like a big mall weekend. It was deserted. I mean, again, it was kind of during COVID, so maybe that was part of it, but it just seemed like the age of malls is ending. And it's like and maybe one day the mall will go away and that cemetery will remain. It's just a shame, you know?
It's so funny that you mentioned that, because I drove, we left New Ipswich this morning. New Ipswich is roughly between Jaffrey Ringe and like Mason, Hollis, Brookline. Most people don't know where it is, and it's fine because it's just not really on any major road. But you pass through a small town called Greenville, and Greenville is like a small, dense town that was like maybe a few thousand people. It was a mill town, like every other small town.
Most of New Hampshire.
But there was like a, you know, there's a department store at one point. There was actually activity, business activity, but it kind of died out with the factory closing and so forth. But even though it's a density is quite there, it's just no one really goes shopping anywhere. There's just no need for it. And everything, you see Amazon trucks two to three times a day dropping everything off. So there is no need for like a central business district.
Right.
That is the first sign that, you know, things were changing with malls, because you got big box stores. I'm not sure how old you are, but I'm in my late 30s. I remember when big box stores were being introduced even in larger cities, and it was just like, oh no, this is going to be the death of downtown. And it, to a certain extent, they're right.
Yeah.
And now Amazon's coming along and it's destroying the big box stores. Right. It's like hilarious how like little fish is being eaten by the big fish, and the big fish is getting eaten by even bigger fish.
Right.
And I'm a little like, I'm not so sympathetic towards malls.
Yeah.
But it being closing down, except for the poor, you know, minimum wage workers that are working there. Yeah. But at the same time, it's like,
they're just sad places to be.
But they are weird. It is weird to walk around and be like, that's so strange.
And another bear store. And it's like, I was in a mall, the one that's closest to here, a few years ago. I stay away as much as possible just because they're kind of depressing places.
Can be. Yeah.
And but as I was walking around, I'm like, because I remember being a kid and that mall was hopping. Like, that was like the
place.
That's
where you met people.
There was two of them. They were right next to each other in this town, in this city. But it was like, you know, it's just sad to see it go, but everybody's like vision of the future changes so rapidly nowadays. Because like, you're right, back in the early 90s when Walmart was really starting to spread out across the country and the world, they're like, yep, this is it. This is the future of, you know, this is how you're going to shop from now on, is everything is in this one gigantic store. I will avoid Walmart as much as possible just because it's such a pain in the butt. You know, if you pick up one thing on one side of the store and then, oh, I got to go a quarter of a mile just to get to the other one. And so it's like, but, you know, speaking of satirical type stuff, I think about George Romero's Dawn of the Dead and malls. And that was in the 70s, you know, so he kind of saw it coming before everybody else did.
Really?
And
then, he thought of the dead as kind of being like the masses that are going around, you know, busting out unfettered capitalism and being consumerists. Was that his take?
Either that, or it was just like the malls are going to be dead, you know. And that
I see.
You're going to be able to find barren malls, and you can hold up in there. Cause,
you know that scene in Blues Brothers, the crazy car chase scene? Not the end, but like midway through, it's just a couple of cops, and they're chasing the Blues Brothers. They destroy a mall in the process. Mm-hmm. That mall was already closed. They basically trashed a mall that was about to be demolished.
Yeah.
And malls come and go. I don't know if mall uptake has been around. One thing on malls, the history of malls, I don't know, I read this a long time ago, but the original strip malls were developed to kind of embody the type of shopping that you got in Europe.
It doesn't seem very European to me.
I know, right? But it was an attempt.
Yeah.
It's kind of like getting chow mein in a can, or you know, like getting some sort of like mac and cheese used to be like considered a luxury food.
Yeah.
But it became kind of weirdly like, the cheapest thing you can get, right?
Powdered stuff, and
that's a kind of story I always see, at least.
Yeah. Well, we just listed off probably about a dozen different primary sources, but that's fine. This is the hell that I live in. Is everywhere I look, I'm like, there's another one.
Oh, so you saying that like on a primary? I just want to get this clear because I'm curious about that phrase. Everything's a primary source, right?
Yeah.
So I love it. I think it's really cool. So basically, you're saying that everything people are producing, even though it's considered perhaps a little bit trash, it's still a primary source that explains like a historical.
The form that we looked at. Yeah. You can apply to anything.
Uh-huh.
And I actually tried to adjust it one time when I was teaching a class about movies and TV shows.
Right.
And I was like moving things around with the different questions. I'm like, no, wait a minute. If I just keep it as is.
Yeah.
Like the same question that a museum curator would use.
Right.
To identify an object that they're putting into.
Got it.
You can do it at a video rental store. You could do it at a thrift store, junk store, yard sale, anything. And like, you know, so like we were looking at the Forrest Gump books.
That's
you know, the original one, you know, even before this cover was written in 1986, this version came out with the movie just to show you like, oh, look, the movie has been made.
Uh-huh.
But then just like Michael Crichton's Lost World,
yep.
New Jurassic Park 2,
mm-hmm.
was written after the success of the movie.
Uh-huh.
Gump and Company was written after the success of Forrest Gump. So the book, this book, the sequel is actually more based on the movie than it is on the book, which if you're a fan of the book, like I am, I love the book.
Huh.
I like the movie a lot, but I love the book. It's so different.
The Winston Groom apparently hated the movie.
Yeah, well, he wrote the first draft to the screenplay.
And then they changed
it. Based
on
his book. Yeah. And they're like, what is this? We can't make a movie out of that.
Novelists cannot... Right. Well, that's not always true, but most novelists can't write a good script.
Oh. Unless that's what they're writing it for.
Yeah.
You know, if they're writing, because like Jaws, I think, was actually, if you see the proximity of when that was written from book to becoming a movie.
Uh-huh.
I think it was like, I'm writing this book just so it'd be picked up by a movie studio. Because,
yeah.
I mean, that's obviously a much more visually captivating story.
Yeah.
But if you're just reading about a killer shark, it's not as exciting as a movie about it. Whereas like this one, I mean, I see them two separate things. Like the right. movie's fantastic.
Mm-hmm.
I'm surprised how many kids nowadays have never seen Forrest Gump. Like my students, I'm like, I thought it was kind of like a, you know, cornerstone film. Like you kind of had to see it.
Well, I don't know what their equivalent would be nowadays.
Yeah, because I don't know, the care doesn't seem to go into those kinds of films anymore. But
it'll be revised.
But the book is so good. And the sequel is fun. It's because it romps further into the 80s and goes into the 90s. So it's a little bit more, but it's like, it's almost like while reading it, like because the Forrest Gump that they create in the book doesn't look anything like Tom Hanks. Like he describes himself. He's a big dude.
Yeah.
Kind of, you know, overweight a little bit.
Should have been the guy from Barton Fink.
Yeah, something a little bit closer to that, yeah.
Yeah, it would have been like, what's his face? I can't remember. He's also something else and something else. yeah, but I got you. He's a big guy.
And then they make Tom Hanks, so as I'm reading this one, I'm like, wait, which one is it? Who am I picturing doing this stupid stuff, creating New Coke? That's another part of the new one.
Really?
Is they pin that on him. So I know you got to get going, but...
I know, it sucks, because I like talking about this
stuff. Well, I'll tell you what. This is a short episode, but... you have my card, so
yeah.
We can do a long episode.
Sure, man.
Anytime.
Yeah, absolutely.
So it's
you should come to New Ipswich and hang out at the Green Center, because we basically have it's like a town thing where every second weekend of the month you bring in the stuff you don't need in your house, you drop it off. The town turned their old highway department building into like this like yard sale, and then every odd Saturday, you basically the town comes by and like, oh yeah, I do need that, or I need this. We got all our kids' toys from there.
You're speaking my language.
Dude, it's a really cool system, and it's amazing. But that's yeah, awesome. Like yeah, I'd love to talk. This is my awesome. This is my jam.
Well, I'm glad I approached you.
No problem.
Have a great rest of your day.
Yeah, you too. See you.
I invite you to access the show notes on Substack to learn more about this movie and how it documents the past. Find me on Instagram for daily history through pop culture entries, and be sure to rate, share, and follow this podcast wherever you're listening to it right now. The hub for all of this is everything-history.com. Join me next time on the EPS podcast, where everything, including 1964's Dr. Strangelove, is a primary source.